Hello and welcome to the Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast in the Inner Sanctum. I thought this week I would take us through Tolkien's very famous lecture, which was published as an essay on fairy stories. And this very famous lecture or essay is central to our understanding of Tolkien's philosophy of myth. And I'm currently teaching a course for Memorial College, an online course on Tolkien, which professes to go beyond and behind the Lord of the Rings. In order to go beyond and behind the Lord of the Rings, we have to understand what informed, if you like, the poetic vision of myth making behind the creation of Middle Earth. And we find it in this lecture on fairy stories. So I'm going to just pick it up and just pluck some lines and comment upon them, just get as far as we can, and maybe I'll continue next week with this, or maybe I won't. We'll see. So I'm going to read, actually begin with a long passage. It's actually only one paragraph, but it's a long paragraph about language. We need to remember, of course, that Tolkien was, for his day job, a philologist, so a professor of languages at the University of Oxford. So he knows what he's talking about, and there's a lot for us to learn from him here. So, philology has been dethroned from the high place it once had in this court of inquiry. Max Müller's view of mythology as a, quote, disease of language, end quote, can be abandoned without regret. Mythology is not a disease at all, though it may, like all human things, become diseased. You might as well say that thinking is a disease of the mind. It would be more near the truth to say that languages, especially modern European languages, are a disease of mythology. But language cannot all the same be dismissed. The incarnate mind, the tongue, and the tail are in our world coeval. The human mind, endowed with the powers of generalization and abstraction, sees not only green grass, discriminating it from other things and finding it fair to look upon, but sees that it is green as well as being grass. But how powerful, how stimulating to the very faculty that produced it was the invention of the adjective. No spell or incantation in fairy is more potent. And that is not surprising. Such incantations might indeed be said to be only another view of adjectives, a part of speech in a mythical grammar. The mind that thought of light, heavy, grey, yellow, still, swift, also conceived of magic that would make heavy things light and able to fly, turn grey lead into yellow gold, and the still rock into swift water. If it could do the one, it could do the other. It inevitably did both. When we can take green from grass, blue from heaven, and red from blood, we have already an enchanter's power upon one plane, and the desire to wield that power in the world external to our minds awakes. It does not follow that we shall use that power well upon any plane. We may put a deadly green upon a man's face and produce a horror. We may make the rare and terrible blue moon to shine. We may cause woods to spring with silver leaves and rams to wear fleeces of gold and put hot fire into the belly of the cold worm. But in such fantasy, as it is called, new form is made. Fairy begins. Man becomes a sub-creator. So that's beautiful and deep from Tolkien. But the key thing there, I think, is that, first of all, that modern languages are in the process of decay. Anybody that looks at modern English and compares it with Shakespeare's English, for instance, will see that that's the case. And if you were Tolkien, he would say, actually, if you look at Shakespeare's in English and compare it with Old English, that you'll see the decay. That's perhaps more debatable. Obviously, in 1066, with the arrival of the Normans, the French language became an ingredient of the English language. Tolkien preferred the purer pre-French form of the language, Old English. That's a matter of preference. But either way, I think there's no real doubt that when a culture decays, so does the language. And I suppose he might argue it might be the other way around, that the decay of language leads to the decay of culture. A good question. But the other key thing in this is that, where is the word coeval here? Let's find it again, towards the beginning. Yes, the incarnate mind, the tongue, and the tail are in our world coeval. Tail, there's T-A-L-E, of course, not T-A-I-L. In other words, that we can't separate them, and they all go back to the primal beginnings of what it is to be human, that the incarnate mind, in other words, the mind that perceives reality through the physical senses. So the incarnate mind, the tongue, the ability to communicate what we experience, and the tale, the telling of stories as a consequence of being able to communicate what we experience, are all coeval. They all go back to the beginning of things. So if you like, fairy mythology, mythopoeia, the making of stories, is something that belongs to the very being from the very beginning of humanity. Let's move on. This is, again, very important for understanding the Lord of the Rings. Even fairy stories as a whole have three faces: the mystical towards the supernatural, the magical towards nature, and the mirror of scorn and pity towards man. And just to skip a couple of lines, the magical, the fairy story, may be used as a mirror de l'homme, in other words, as a mirror of man, and it may, but not so easily, be made a vehicle of mystery. So let's look at this again. Fairy stories have three faces: mystical towards the supernatural, okay, so ultimately towards the divine. And of course, other aspects of the divine might be the angelic or the demonic. So that's the mystical aspect of fairy stories. The magical is towards nature. So again, for Tolkien, magic is something natural. And there's a various forms of that. So for instance, technology is magic. It's the use of technique to dominate and domineer nature. That's why you have this fusion when you go back far enough, and the confusion when you come to our own time, in consequence of the so-called scientist, as we would now call him, and the alchemist, and the obsession of medieval alchemists, medieval magicians, were twofold. The quest for the elixir of life, in other words, being able to live forever, immortally, not eternally, there's a big difference, immortally in this veil of tears, to live forever, the elixir of life. And also the philosopher's stone, this magical catalyst which will enable us to turn base metal into gold. So what are the two motives of alchemy? One is immortality, living as long as possible, and the other is getting rich and therefore powerful through wealth. And if you look at it, the modern pharmaceutical industry and the modern medical industry are fused together very alchemically. It's the modern alchemy, if you like, the elixir of life and making lots of money. So something has continued. So that's the magical. But then there's another form of magic that's not magic at all, Tolkien says, but might appear to be magic. So, for instance, elves have powers that humans don't have. Even hobbits have powers that humans don't have. They can sort of disappear or not be seen, shall we say. But these are natural to the hobbits and natural to the elves. They're not supernatural. They would appear to be supernatural if we had those powers, but then because they're not natural to us. And the analogy in the modern world would be something like animals in nature. Let's say, for instance, a deer. Now, a deer has better hearing than we do, a better sense of smell than we do. And so more often than not, unless we're being very careful and very quiet or very still, that the deer will perceive that we're there before we perceive him, and it will disappear. If we had the sense of smell that that a deer has, I could run and jump like a deer, we would be seen as superhuman. If we could fly like a bird, but the flight of a bird is not magic. It's not miraculous. It's not supernatural. It's purely natural for the bird. And then the fact that the stories of all sorts, and fairy stories in particular here, can hold up a mirror to nature. I don't know. I'll be quiet for a moment to see if there's any background noise I could detect. Doesn't look like it very much. Maybe very slightly. I've got the landscape out and I can hear him through the window. So I might cut this fairly short fairly soon because you don't want that background noise. Maybe another couple of comments takes up to our usual length. So we're still on fairy stories here. Moving on, it says, again, plucking another line from this essay, history often resembles myth because they're both ultimately of the same stuff. Okay, so one thing, of course, we have to understand here is that myth does not mean, when Tolkien uses it, ever, something which is untrue. So modern understanding of the word myth is that something which is false or a lie. Some say that's a myth, meaning it's a lie. Tolkien never ever uses myth in that way. Use it in the correct sense, the Greek sense, the word myth, mythos. It's just a story. Now, a story can be true or it can be untrue. It can be true in the sense of factually true, something that actually happened in our world, or it can be true in the sense of a fictional narrative, such as the parable of the prodigal son, which is not true in the factual sense, in the sense that the parable son is a work of fiction, a product, a figment of our Lord's imagination. But of course, it conveys a great deal of truth about who we are. It holds up that mirror to man that of which Tolkien speaks. So history, of course, is also a story. We can actually should see it in terms of providence and see history as his story. So the history of man is the story of man. The history of our own particular life is our life story. So it is true that history resembles myth because they are both ultimately made of the same stuff. And I'm just going to finish with one other quote from this, and maybe I'll mark it, and perhaps we'll continue next week. We'll continue our discussion of Tolkien. So this one final line. Small wonder that spell means both a story told and a formula of power over living men. Okay, this is, of course, Old English. The word spell means a story. It also means a magician's spell, right? Having power, almost magical power over others. And also, he doesn't mention here directly, of course, linguistically, when we spell a word, we are simultaneously telling a story. Even a single word, like spelling a word like dog, we are raising in people's minds the image of a four-legged canine. Images come to life. Stories are beginning to be told. If I just said the dog walks, we now have a moving image. So to spell a word is to have the same sort of power over reality, if you like, as a magician who casts a spell. And the word spell itself means the story told, as Tolkien tells us here. Let's leave it there for the time being. I think I quite like the idea of talking about Tolkien over the next few weeks on the Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast. So thanks so much for joining me this week. Please join me next week where we'll continue looking at Tolkien's famous essay on fairy stories. Until then, thanks for being a member of the Inner Sanctum and supporting me in my work. And until next week, goodbye and God bless.